Welcome to Farming Aotearoa with Peter Burke. Kia ora and welcome again to another edition of Farming Aotearoa. I'm Catherine Scullin and with me is agricultural journalist Peter Burke to bring us up to date with what's been happening around the country in the past month. So, Peter, what are we talking about this time?
Well, preview for a start. So we'll talk about a very historic application to conduct outside trials for gene editing, which has never been done. I think the last one was around about 10, 15 years ago now. So an interesting development there by AgResearch. Get you an update on the Chatham Islands. We don't hear much about the Chathams except when we see the weather forecast on television at night, but we're going to talk about the problems that their farmers there are facing because of the unreliability of shipping, which has always been a problem. Okay. Nothing new about that. Some numbers out in the last week or so around the cost of getting Hawke's Bay back on its feet from a horticultural perspective. And we've always known there was numbers. Someone has come up with a figure, which we'll talk about. It's actually just over $400 million, which is, and I probably think that's an underestimate of what it is.
Okay.
Have a look at what they're calling havoc season now. It's the calving season about to start.
So havoc season.
Havoc season. That's what they call it now, havoc season, so I'm told. So we'll have a look at that. And then maybe delve a little bit into the challenges that some of our diplomats are having now in quite a complex world where we've got, you know, different people getting elected in different places with different platforms, shall we say.
Yeah.
And how that might affect New Zealand and the growing, shall we say it, view of protectionism, which is around the world, which is not new, it's just starting to build up momentum. So that's sort of and I've got a couple of other things I might talk about if I run out of time, but I've got some other things up my sleeve which I can babble on about, and I won't tell you about those because I don't use them.
Okay, all right, fair enough too. You can surprise us later if we've got more time. I'll take you back then to gene editing ryegrass. I mean, those words together, I look at it and go, what? Why do we need to edit the gene, the ryegrass?
Well, this is about endophytes, not about the actual ryegrass itself.
Okay.
So it's something within the plant. It's not actually they're not actually editing ryegrass as such. And the endophytes, apparently, and this, I'm not a scientist, and I don't want to tell you how good I am at science at school. It was shocking. but these little things are quite important in terms of the protection they offer the ryegrass plant. So endophytes can actually offer protection. Special ones can offer protection against other diseases, which is what they're looking at trying to do, to try and make the perfect ryegrass that will fight off any attacks from disease, and at the same time be palatable to animals. Now, ryegrass has a particular problem. There's a thing called ryegrass staggers, and that's caused by endophytes again. So what they're trying to do is to, tip the balance and say, okay, let's edit these genes to the point that we have an endophyte which is going to be really strong in terms of disease resistance, but also have less harm to the animal that eats the ryegrass. So that's what this is all about. The significance of this is that outdoor trials are very rare in New Zealand. The last one I can remember is back in the last one was around about 2010, which was with Scion, also known as the Forest Research Institute. Why they called it Scion, I'll never know, and I worked for them for a while, but no one could explain what it meant, so I didn't want to understand that. And that was for genetically modified Pinus radiata plants. They had them at a very well-protected facility in Rotorua. Where the ryegrass will be, we're not certain. Probably around Grasslands Complex in the Manawatū, that's where it's likely to be. But this will be very heavily protected. The thing that's interesting about this one is that the endophyte cannot be passed on from plant to plant. It has to be passed on by the seed. So the scientist's view is, as long as they don't allow that grass to seed, there is no risk of it ever going any further, and making sure that birds don't pick up that seed and drop it. So one of the big things about this will be to make sure that these controls, as they call them in the industry, are met. So what happens now is that AgResearch have indicated they want to do this. So they've lodged an application with the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA. EPA will look at what the AgResearch have put together, probably come back to them to get more information so they know what, you know, the quantum of this whole thing is. And over a period of iteration, AgResearch will then have the full idea of what the EPA wants in terms of information to make a decision. Once that has got that, AgResearch will then lodge an application, a full formal application to EPA, and they in turn will put that out for public consultation. So there will be a chance for the public to have input into this. And then finally, a panel from the EPA will make a final decision. So it's a lengthy process. It won't just happen tomorrow. But it's on the road now, I guess, in a sense. And I think this is interesting because it is so significant. It's an historic piece of research that's been carried out. And we'll just see where it goes. But the scientists are upbeat that they think they've done all the trials in the lab, which show that these endophytes that they've developed in the lab in the glasshouse, that they will meet the requirements they want to. In other words, they will protect the plant, they will not harm the animal so much. They've got to put it out in the field now just to make sure that this will do it. They have done these similar trials in Australia, interestingly enough, in Victoria and in New South Wales, and the results there show that what they're doing in New Zealand will work in Australia. However, I guess the question is now, will it work in New Zealand? So that's what this is all about. So it's a process of research. It's a pretty simple one. It's not genetic engineering in the wider sense that would alarm people, as it has done in the past. This is quite simply editing of a particular part of the ryegrass, not the whole ryegrass.
So from a gardener's perspective, if you're putting on a very amateur hat like mine, I'm thinking, you can go to my place and get grass, no problem at all. There's no problem with the way that my grass grows. Why is there a problem with the way is it what it feeds then onto the animal?
I guess what you're looking at in ryegrass, ryegrass is the basic animal food in New Zealand, if you like, from a pasture perspective. So the better quality your ryegrass is, the better quality your animals will grow, mm-hmm. the better milk the cows will produce, the better meat that the animals will produce, and so on and so on. So it's in our interest to get that along, but there are other it's one of many species of herbage, if you like, that we put through our animals, but it is the predominant one probably. Okay. And so getting ryegrass right is really big.
Okay.
So that's
all right, interesting.
And I enjoy talking to scientists. They're very great. They're great people.
Yeah.
I think some of them have got this great skill of being able to explain to idiots like me what they're doing and to put it in words of. And I think that's very talented. And I admire scientists who can do that. And I was very lucky to strike a guy who could do that.
Fantastic.
So that's that bit of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for that.
Yeah. So we're talking about Chathams now, eh?
Yeah.
So Chatham Islands, I mean, my notion of Chatham Islands, I've had an association with it over many years as a journalist, and I remember helping to make a film about it once back in the 60s.
Oh, yeah?
And originally it was sort of fishing was the big thing, but farming is very big on the Chathams. And at the moment they're having a real hard time there because the unreliability of shipping, which has always been a problem that's plagued the Chathams, getting animals on and off the island. At the moment, there are something like 28,000 sheep and I think around 7,000 cattle that need to be got off the island to the mainland, to the works, to be processed. But
this is a big but.
There's no ship at the moment. Oh. So this all arose when one of the people from MPI, Dr. John Roach, who was in charge of their what they call on-farm support group, went to the Chathams, talked to farmers and said, what's the problem here? What can we do about it? And I talked to John recently. He's a great scientist and a great farm person. MPI are now going out there and trying to work with the farmers, the shipping companies and everyone else to make sure that they can get a reliable shipping service going to get these animals off the island because we're coming up to that time, you know, I sort of call it havoc season, calving time, of course, lambing time, of course, the same thing. And there's going to be a whole lot of new lambs born on the island, a whole lot of new calves, and you can't have the existing sheep that are there staying there. A, they'll run out of feed, but secondly, the last year's lambs will rapidly turn into two-tooths, as we call them. They'll become worth less if they don't get them off soon. They won't be able to process them as lambs. So there is quite a big problem there, and that's... And that is something hopefully will be resolved sooner rather than later. But they're having a look at, I think one of the things is can we speed up the process of getting these animals off the island? Can we get the farmers, have them down at the wharf ready to go quicker, load up the ship, get it away, get it back quickly, get another load on and so on. And that's what they're looking at doing, which is interesting. The other interesting thing I didn't know about, and he told me, which is quite fascinating, is that they have a problem with feral cattle on the island. Now, these are cattle that have obviously been on farms before. They've got out and they've gone rogue, and they're probably pretty old. They wouldn't be worth eating. They'd be, you know, bit like the way you cook a pukeka. You put a rock and a pukeka in the pot and you eat the rock, as I say. Anyway, but that's what they amount to. But the problem with these animals are that they're getting through. They're quite big, obviously, cattle. They're breaking through the fences. They're getting onto the ordinary farms, and they're causing problems for the farmers and eating the feed that should be used for their own stock. So they've set up an operation there at the moment going on, which is to get a helicopter in so they can shoot them from the helicopter. It's a bit like culling, deer culling, really, in effect. They've got to do that. If they don't do it, there becomes a problem with these rogue animals eating feed, causing mayhem, starving the other existing animals. So it's a really interesting story. And the Chatham is, you know, we tend to forget about the farming is big for them, but it is. Fishing is big, but so is farming. And you feel for these people whose livelihood, everything they get, has to come in by ship or by aircraft. People fly there generally now. They don't go by ship. But, you know, everything is more expensive there. Fuel is expensive. You need to get everything you get on the Chathams is much more expensive than the mainland. And I think to be without it is a big problem. And that's something that we see positive happening now with MPI getting in there and trying to, not to tell farmers what to do, but to try and work with them to say, what do you want us to do to try and get this thing going back on its feet again and start to push a few buttons and get people to realise the extent of the problem, because it is one. Mm. I thought the Chathams was really interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting. I didn't realise they farmed like that at all.
No, they're big farmers. And, you know, when you think of it, there's 28,000 sheep to go off the island. It's a lot of sheep to get off the island.
Yeah.
It's a big number. And the cattle numbers are big too. So they'll take that will take several months to move that lot, but they've got to start to get it done sooner rather than later. Yeah.
All right, let's move back onto the mainland then and the cyclone update.
Yeah. I mean,
recovery update, I should say.
Yeah, the recovery is interesting, isn't it? I mean, we're seeing on television at the moment the problems that Wairoa is having, particularly urban Wairoa, because of the flooding that occurred there, and certainly a lot of criticism of the Hawke's Bay Regional Council by the council and by people for not acting, in their view, the way they should have acted to stop that, prevent that flooding. And that the last amount of rain came through had a very urban effect in Wairoa, not so much on the farms at the backcountry, but more because of this flooding caused by the river.
Right.
But right through the whole Tairawhiti and down to Hawke's Bay, there are still problems around farms. If you talk to farmers up in Tairawhiti, they'll tell you that the land is still moving. They can't get their fences in properly. They can't put permanent fences in because they put a post in today and tomorrow the land will have slipped and it's gone. That's still going on a year afterwards.
Wow.
But the interesting news this week was around horticulture and particularly Hawke's Bay, focusing on that. And a report's been done by the Boston Group, pro bono, well, good on them for doing that, but saying that it needs at least another $410 million to get that area up and running. And that's just a number, and I'm not sure that's even high enough. I'm unconvinced about the number. It's probably low. I suspect it's a conservative one. Because when you look at the damage there, you look at what's required to do it. An orchard, if you've lost an orchard, you've got to plant trees. So you've got to get the trees, plant them. You won't get a commercial crop for 8 years, for 7 years. But one orchard has told me he would believe that it would take 12 years to get a commercial return on that orchard, on those plantings.
It's a long time.
It's a long time. So this is not just a case of a bunch of cabbages wiped out and you can plant another lot. It's a long-term fix. And the worry is that in that time, the region needs support. And people say government, and yes, probably, but what it probably needs is investment. And there's a lot of the people I've been talking to are saying, well, yes, we need government, that's fine, that's important, but also we'll probably need investors in there. Some of the bigger orchards are saying to me that they may have to get extra capital in to keep their businesses going, which they don't really want. These are family businesses, family corporates, if you like, and that's what a lot of them are. How can we, if we've lost 20% of our crop, which I know one has, how do we fund that? Is that not going to be viable until the next generation take over?
Mm.
And it's probably not a generational thing now. I suspect that Hawke's Bay will take a generation to recover from this. It's sad because it's a great region. It grows amazing apples. It's the biggest apple-growing area in New Zealand. It's very big in kiwi fruit now. There's a very big Māori development there doing kiwi fruit, Ngāi Takarangi. I've got a very big 40-hectare orchard, kiwi fruit orchard there. And I don't know. It breaks my heart a little bit to think that, dare I say, we're putting cycleways in Island Bay, but we're not fixing the road between Wairoa and Napier. And I think I feel a bit disgusted by some of the stupid decisions that are being made in government at the moment, quite frankly.
It is a bit mad to consider that a food chain and people and farmers
are being... Because a few idiots want to ride around e-bikes around Wellington and other districts. And I just don't get it. I know I'll be unpopular for saying it. I don't care. To me...
I think only unpopular to those riding the bikes. I don't think there's that many of them listening
But the people of Wairoa, you know, for example, to still get from Wairoa to Napier is still a three-hour journey. And I remember asking Craig Little, the mayor of Wairoa, what has changed in the last year. He said, there are more orange cones on the road now.
Right.
The road is no better. There are still nine sets of traffic lights between Wairoa and Napier. And I think this is a case of, you know, fiddling while Rome burns, quite frankly. And it annoys me to see that this area is not being addressed. It's a region that is economically strong, but, you know, come on. And I think the interesting comment made by one of the people from Wairoa said to the regional council, we don't want another meeting, we don't want another sort of group family conference, if you like, around this thing. We don't want another series of coffees and sausage rolls, another meeting that will do nothing. We just want you to do something positive. And I think people are getting sick of these meetings that come along and there's talk fest, oh, we'll do this, we'll do that. And quite frankly, nothing much is done.
Right.
And
is this at a local government level? Or is it?
I think the local government I'm not going to get into criticising regional councils, but I've got a view on it. They can ring me if they want to personally. I've worked for them. Some of them are good, some of them are pretty awful, are pretty average in my view. I can't comment on Hawke's Bay, but certainly the farming guys I'm talking to are very annoyed about the way that Hawke's Bay Regional Council have handled it. They haven't apologised for it. They haven't admitted they made a mistake. And I think it's pretty clear they did make a mistake. Well, someone made a mistake. This wasn't an act of God. This was an act of man. And I'm just, anyway. So, but otherwise, there's been other good, positive things about that as well. So we'll leave it at that, I think, probably rather than me do a rant.
All right. What's next on our list?
Well, the next thing is interesting. We're going through at the moment a whole lot. The world is changing, and it has always changed. That's nothing new. But we went through a period of time when what we call rules-based trade occurred, where there was institutions such as the World Trade Organization, the WTO, were set up, at which point people agreed that they would operate within certain boundaries on trade. And that was very successful. It worked for New Zealand because as a small country, we don't have much power in terms of what we can leverage. We're minnows. We primary exports are a big thing, but in terms of world, we're tiny. But what's happening now is with the United States and China and Russia and others, certainly the US and China, they're not abiding by the rules of trade anymore. They're gone. The WTO is effectively, I guess, castrated, if you like, by these other countries who are taking their own view of how they want to do trade, and that is affecting New Zealand. Now, we've been quite fortunate that we've had some brilliant people who've been our trade negotiators, and I know some of them. They're fabulous individuals who are highly talented. They're not gifted amateurs. They're really, you know, years of experience, and they've put together our FTAs. They're saying now the golden era of FTAs is over, probably, and it's going to be incremental. Yes, we'll try and do some deals, but it's going to be that much harder than it was, say, 10 or 15 years ago. And that's all about this whole world that we're living in, which is turmoil. Mm. You know, we've got the war in Ukraine, we've got the Middle East, all these things are contributing, and we've had COVID, of course, all of which are making, and there's this view of protectionism, food security, China's increasing its milk production, all these things are mitigating and making things a disorder, if you like. And there's no, and you know, just briefly again, looking at, say, dairy, which is a big thing for New Zealand, it's going to be challenging because milk production is increasing, China is not buying, and China is a big player in that, whatever way we like to look at it. And if that's the case, then there almost becomes disorder in that area of the market. So the question for dairy farmers this year will be, what will the milk price be? That's what they're after. They want to know that. I'm told that the month of August is going to be the critical time for that. That once we see, you might hear on the radio, the GTT auctions, the price of the prices that are going to be set in August will probably determine in the long term what the prices the farmers will get for their milk at the end of the year, because that's when the bulk of the product is sold, produced. So we're going to have an interesting August, I think,
okay,
to see what happens in the dairy industry in particular. And then also, I guess, you've got elections in America, you've got challenges in France, all over the show. How is that going to play out? And how is that going to play out for New Zealand? And I don't know. And I don't think anyone does. We're just crossing our fingers and all the other bits so we can cross.
Oh, that's bizarre, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Okay, your favourite time of the year, calving season?
Calving season.
What are you calling it? What do you call it
they
before?
Call it, well, one farming consultant told me this week, he called it the havoc season. And I think that's because it is, you know, it goes on all the time. People work long hours. You've got, the cows don't sort of operate between 9 and 5. They're not part of the, there's not a trade union of cows anymore.
No, they want to have their calves at about, you know, 2 in the morning or something on a wet night. And
you've got to be up at 2 in the morning to be there to help that, yeah, and bring that calf in and get them all sorted out. So, yeah. Our dairy farmers and their great staff are going to be working overtime in very difficult conditions, potentially wet, muddy, windy, cold, and you know. So think about dairy farmers. It's not just like when you buy a bottle of milk. Think of how it gets there.
Yeah,
just
think about the poor cow going through all that as well.
I know
that
the poor
weather.
Cow, but then the calf gets taken away from her eventually, and you know, it's all very sad. But it's a bit like Bambi, but we can't help that.
Well, you can if you're like me and you just drink sweet.
Yeah,
milk,
no.
Or
see, I'm,
but yeah, so just be a bit more respectful of your milk when you get it.
I think so. Milk. All your products are there by hijacker. They're not there by just turning up on a day.
Yeah.
It's not all gin and tonics on the brand are it anymore. It's damn hard work out there. And as a life sentence block farmer,
was it ever been gin and tonic on the veranda?
Oh yes, I love gin and tonic on the veranda.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
Normally you think of our farmers as so hardworking anyway, apart from you and your gin and tonic on the veranda.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, that means the farm goes to the pots, doesn't it?
Ah, see, that's so what
you
happens.
Farmers work very hard, and I think that's what we forget. It is a seven-day-a-week operation. It's not a five-day-a-week operation. You can't take the weekends off. Or there are times in the year when it's quieter, but by and large, you've got to be around animals. They need...
Yeah.
You know, and that's what any animal needs, someone to be around them.
Absolutely. So that's why they call it havoc season.
Yeah, havoc season. But calving is really quite manic.
It's manic, okay.
I suppose that's another way of describing it.
Yeah.
Or it might be just beautiful, I don't know.
Well, the calves certainly are very cute.
They are, yeah, some of them.
Yeah, yeah. Some of them, all of them.
All right.
All babies are cute.
Yes, they are.
Aren't they? True.
Yes, they are, probably.
Okay. Have you got any other surprises for us?
Not really. I think probably the things I've talked about with that, I think calving was my main thing.
Okay.
August calving were two big things, and I think probably just looking and seeing what comes out of the August will be an interesting time, both in terms of calving, and then the other thing I guess is whether we get the weather. That's a factor, of course. At the moment, the weather's been pretty kind to farmers, but we don't know what's going to spring up. And there was talk of El Nino again this year,
right,
which could bring rain, which could make things difficult later in the year, because last year El Nino did play a part in reducing milk production at the end of the season. And at the moment, depending on what the production around El Nino will be, that will probably give us a fairly good idea of what our local milk production will be. The early indications are it's going to be high. People are saying, maybe not, maybe yes, maybe no, I don't know. And the other thing that's happening, of course, there's lots of conferences on. You can go to conferences, to anything you want to go to.
So what sort of conferences are you talking about, Peter?
Well, there's about three quite important ones coming up. There's one around the red meat sector conference, which is the red meat sector is primarily meat processors. So it'll be a lot of talk around what this current season is going to be looking like, how the markets are operating at the moment. Again, we've also got this China factor, which sort of looms every time you talk about market, the word China emerges. And that is quite something I'm sure that will be talked about as well. The issues now are becoming clear too around getting product to market, where traditionally we've sent product quite easily over to Europe and that sort of thing. The shipping routes have been easy, but of course we know that we've had the problems in the Red Sea. Mm. That's delayed it. We had that during COVID as well. We've had all sorts of things. And I think people are being a bit more wary about where our future lies. I think it's clear that Southeast Asia is going to be the future for us. We know that there is opportunities there. There's new countries such as Vietnam, which has a growing what they call middle class, so people who are looking for better quality food, and countries like Vietnam. India is going to be a challenge for New Zealand, because every country we look at trying to put a free trade agreement with, dairy always looms as being a problem, because most of these countries have got their own dairy industry sector, and India is one of those. And you know, there are more cows in India than any other country in the world for memory. And China's got the most sheep, believe it or not, which is fascinating.
Gee.
So you're seeing in those, and the dairy is always going to be an issue. And I've just got a question mark in my mind. I have no answers for it. I'm just a question is, how long will this last for New Zealand? Because at the moment, I think the dairy industry earns about $25 billion worth of cash for New Zealand. The next biggest is meat at around about $12 billion. So dairy is twice that of sheep and beef. And if other countries are being resistant to allowing imports, and places like China are growing their own dairy industry, it's not growing massively, but it is growing. And then their economy is sort of fading a bit. It's sort of static, if you like. How does that look for New Zealand imports? Mm. I don't know. And so that's going to be, I think, a big issue for New Zealand. And I remember once being told by the late Mike Moore, former trade minister, prime minister for so many weeks, who said China will grow old before it grows rich.
Mm.
What we're seeing in China is that the one-child policy is starting to pan out now, and therefore there is fewer people, therefore demand is lower. There was all sorts of, it's almost the Celtic Tiger occurred in China, that the property market went bust. There was less money there. And that's a problem. The one bright spark on all of this actually is horticulture. And if you talk to say people like Zestri, kiwi fruit is regarded as a very, very desirable, healthy product. And what we're not seeing in China is any resistance to, say, kiwi fruit. That the sales are going well there, because people see kiwi fruit as being something that is a health, as beneficial to health, and it is. That's scientifically proven so. And therefore, my question might be that, and we've always sort of marketed ourselves as being clean and green. I don't think that will change, but I think probably we need to include in that health as well, because our protein, our meat, our dairy products are also very healthy products. They're good ones. I think the consumer now is looking for health as much as they are looking for whatever. They're looking to see different things like how are animals treated? And I'm questioning, there's questions being raised, I won't get into it, but the issue of live exports, will that be a positive or a negative for New Zealand? And a lot of people will tell you it's a negative, because if animals are seen to be treated badly, then New Zealand will be seen to be treating its animals badly. Therefore, it may act against New Zealand in the marketplace. That's a strong argument that's being put up at the moment. And every other country in the world that I know of is against live exports.
Mm-hmm.
We are now turning back the clock to go that way. Whether we do or not, I don't know, but that's an issue which is, it's a debate to be had. But I think the question remains is, little nuances like that, of how you treat your animals, do we have cows up there in hocks and mud? How will that help us? And I don't think people at home realise that everything they do and say, that most people have a cell phone, that image gets out to the world pretty quickly.
Mm.
And you can't hide anything anymore. And people are discerning customers. We don't sell to the starving millions. We sell to the discerning hundreds of thousands. And we can't afford to stuff up, to put it crudely. And that's where I really have a concern at the moment as to whether everyone in New Zealand has got that view and think, oh, well, she'll be right. Well, two things, she will never be right.
Mm.
And then get over the idea of the number eight wire stuff, which is, to me, old hat and irrelevant and silly. It's a childish. Most people have never seen number eight wire anyway. They talk about, I'm sure I've got a bit on my farm, but I don't know many people have seen a piece of number eight wire and wouldn't know what it looked like. So stop that sort of rhetoric and get down to reality. That's sort of the mission, I think, probably. But horticulture stands out as being potentially, it could overtake sheep and beef as an area for New Zealand potentially in the future.
Yeah, well, if you're looking at a product that shows that there's no impact on the environment, there's no impact on an animal,
yeah,
great impact on human health,
yeah,
why not?
Exactly. So,
well, wouldn't it be good?
That's the positive side. Yeah. The question is who will steal our product, and right. Chinese have done that. It's hard to protect our IP.
Yeah.
And the question is, you know, if we don't sell stuff to countries, will others do it instead of us, and we'll just lose out. So I don't know the argument, and I'm not going to try and be a judge, and I'm not competent to do that.
Okay, well, the next time you're in, I'm sure we'll get an update on probably milk prices, how the havoc season's going, and some of these
conferences. Yes, I'll be doing some things like that.
Wonderful. Well, enjoy your G&T on the veranda, and we'll see you next time.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.